The following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you could join in today. And before we get started, I want to remind you that we may discuss certain tax strategies or certain private partnership, real estate related syndication investments, and other topics which I would throw into the category of non-DIY. So let's have you check with your current advisors. Hopefully they're folks that know your unique facts and circumstances and can advise whether what you thought you heard was one, accurate, and two, might have something to do with your unique facts and circumstances before you rush off and implement something that you may regret. And, you know, I get questions routinely from folks that I are that may have heard the show or that maybe I've gotten a phone call from. And it's amazing how people, myself included at times, you know, we hear what we want to hear when you're dealing with tax or investment opportunities. And, you know, I know I've seen many people over the years that have joined into real estate private partnership syndications, and they don't seem to understand that a syndication is not necessarily a monolithic item. They're all different. Every one of them's different. And I know you can say, well, I understand there are different apartment buildings in different parts of the country or different parts of the city that you're in. No, I mean the financial metrics are markedly different between almost every project. And by that I mean, you know, the cash flow that might come out or might not come out. Maybe it's like a transaction that I invested in at one point that didn't have any payments projected. It has one at the end when the property is exited. Well, if you're someone that needs money for your retirement now, that's not a good option for you. I don't care what the IRR is or the ROI or any of the other acronyms you want to throw at it, the EMX, the equity multiple. And so you have to understand several things. You've got to understand at base, you have to understand what a partnership consists of. And so we're going to talk a little bit today as to what is a partnership? How do partnerships function? What will you own if you buy a partnership interest? And then we'll move from there into the real estate dynamics and how that will overlay the concept of a partnership. Anyway, if you don't have if you don't have advisors that currently consult or understand how partnerships work, how real estate taxation works, a lot of good CPAs out there that don't do much with real estate. And I know I used to be one many, many years ago. Pains me to think about how long ago that's been. But, you know, if you wanted to learn more about manufacturing accounting and taxation. Don't come to me. I'm not your guy or your gal in any event. It's something I've rarely worked in. I've had a few clients along the way back when I was younger and would take on almost anything that walked in the door. Don't do that anymore. I'm hyper-focused on real estate, private partnerships, and self-directed 401 trust, which is absolutely the best vehicle to invest in real estate with. Whether you're speaking about different retirement plans or just plain old cash, money market accounts, the 401 trust has certain advantages that nothing else under the tax code has. And I'm referring to either the pre-tax option, or if you want to utilize the Roth side of that trust, which is what I recommend, especially as we get closer to the ultimate arrival of the tax train that's barreling down the tracks. And it's not a train you want to get on. I can assure you, you want to avoid that train. And I'll explain how we can do that, or at least some ways we can do that. And in any event, if your advisors don't understand the math behind these types of content, be it partnerships, be it real estate taxes, retirement plan taxation, or the zero tax bracket, which is what we're rushing to get. We want you to get on that train. Let's get on the zero tax bracket train, or tax rate, I should say, train. And let's talk about how we can adjust your income streams as you get to retirement to avoid or certainly minimize. There's some situations where you will not get to the zero tax rate. And just as an example, if you've got a pension, a true classic pension payment coming in each month or each year, if it's more than a few thousand dollars a month, you're likely never going to get to the zero tax rate. But we can get down as close as we get down a lot closer to it than you will otherwise if you don't adjust the other items you can control. But anyway, so if you don't have those types of advisors, feel free to go to our website at baplanner.com. There's a forms link right up in the top, it's second to the right side of that page, the home page at baplanner.com, and complete at least the step one, form one, client profile form, and we'll be able to have a chat that will let you understand how we might sync up with your current objectives. And it's a matter of, is it a good use of your money and our time to work with you? Because as old as I'm getting, that's what I look for, is how can we provide the highest value to folks that have real estate in their investment plans or partnerships or retirement plan strategies, and how do we get money out of a retirement plan? When do we have to take it out? Again, the 401 trust is advantaged, and you have to qualify, but I can tell you very quickly whether or not you would be a prospect for that vehicle. So let's update. Now that we've had a new election, we've got a new regime in place, and I tell you what, if your head's not spinning from all the activity that's gone on in the last week, I got up this morning and noticed that Mr. Trump's plans for the day included both North Carolina and LA, and it's amazing how, I guess, some people don't keep up. I was on the phone talking to my favorite airline as I'm headed back to Southeast Asia sometime here in the next couple weeks, hopefully. Boy, it's hard getting flights right now. The I don't know if it's fewer planes or more flyers. I don't know who you want to believe. But anyway, the office that I deal with is in L.A., and the lady I was speaking to didn't even know that President Trump was going to be touching down in their city today. The airspace will be blocked off, all that stuff that happens. And I thought, you know, it's kind of like people that I hope to expose to the concept of how bad off the federal debt and deficit is. People don't have a clue. They don't understand what's getting ready to hit us here in the next, you know, 4 to 5 years. Maybe they don't worry about things until they're right on top of us, and you have very few choices at that point how to restructure your affairs to avoid. But anyway, foxbusiness.com keeps us updated. They've got a page that I don't think it even has a date on it, because it's just constantly, I guess they've got it connected to the U.S. debt clock .org site, which is a great site. We'll be talking about that as well momentarily. But anyway, as of 1/23/2025, the national debt tracker that Fox Business maintains shows that American taxpayers, you in parentheses, are now on the hook for $36,217,491,000,000, and I'll leave the rounding part off. But in any event, that's a lot of money, and that's just the part that we include in the current year's analysis. That doesn't include the 100 trillion plus additional, what we call the unfunded mandate. And if you look at usdebtclock.org, that's how they refer to it as well. So the total U.S. debt they show at $101 trillion, $470 billion. And that includes the part that we don't include in the current year analysis, which is crazy. If it were you and I and we had a business that had unfunded liabilities, meaning that we had already committed to paying it. We had, well, I guess in the case of the U.S. government, we haven't necessarily received the services yet or the products. I mean, it involves things that maybe new levels of indexing that kicks in on assorted categories of spending, Social Security and Medicare, things of that nature. But it's other things as well. You've got pensions, you know, federal pensions. Of course, all the congressmen have their pensions that are easily earned, at least in terms of the time you have to participate. But in any event, the rapid rise in the U.S. national debt is, it's just hard to get your hands wrapped around. And all I can tell you is it's not slowing down. I have not yet had a chance to review the recently updated CBO, the annual 10-year forecast. I may see if we can find that quickly, and we can bring it up maybe after we get back from the break. But in any event, the national debt, according to Fox's site, it fell to $36,217,000,000,000 as of January 23rd. So I'm not sure. The U.S. debt clock shows it a little bit higher, and I'm not sure what would have caused it to drop. But $36,391,000,000,000 is what the U.S. debt clock shows. But in any event, what's a few billion amongst friends, right? We can accept the lower number. if you look at what the CBO projects, though, for the next 10 years, we've got an average annual deficit. In other words, what we'll add to the stack, the $36 trillion stack, is approximately $2.1 trillion. And in fact, if you look at the next 4 years, the deficits that we've got scheduled for the next 4 years will rise to a record level. It'll be the highest, and I'm presuming this is percentage-wise of the GDP, it'll top the record set back in 1946 at the end of World War II. So let me see if I've got, let's see, CBO projects. Now let me see what this article is dated, because I think this does include the current. This was a year ago. So this was the 10-year study from beginning to early 2024. But in any event, so we've already passed the historical record. But when CBO issued the economic outlook, the 10-year report for 2024 to 2034, they showed that the national debt would soon surpass the size of the U.S. economy and surpass a historical record in 4 years. So 4 years from early 24 would be 2028, I presume. I'm not sure if they're looking at the fiscal year, if they're looking at the calendar year, but in any event, in 2034, the national debt is projected to rise to, by that time, $48.3 trillion for fiscal year 2034. So it's set to rise by, let's see here. CBO projected that the debt held by the public, it's a key metric for tracking the size of the national debt, totaled $26 trillion in 2023 and is set to rise to $27.9 trillion. So that's, the actual amount of treasury bonds that are held or bills. But over the next decade is projected to rise that portion to 48.3. As a percentage of gross domestic product or as compared to the size of the U.S. economy, debt held by the public is projected to reach 99% of GDP in 2024 and will continue to rise over the next 10 years before hitting 116% of GDP in 2034. In effect, this means that the national debt will roughly equal the size of the U.S. economy this year, if CBO's projections end up proving accurate. And the relative growth, or the growth relative, rather, to America's economic output is expected to continue. Debt held by the public rises each year in relation to the size of the economy, reaching 116% of GDP in 2034, an amount greater than at any point in the nation's history. Now, this is CBO, Congressional Budget Office, and they're not, I don't want to say I'll definitely say they're not always right. You might even say they're not often right, or they're not right very often, but it's enough to get your attention. And as a percentage of GDP, the current record by our United States is 106%, and this goes back again to World War II, 1946, and that's just it's just insane. That's all you can say. I mean, it's like, how do we ever pay it? And if you go on, and again, this is from a year ago. I'm going to see if I can grab the current update here on a break. as a frame of reference, as you're monitoring the size of the national debt and the government's fiscal health, by 2034, the deficit is expected to be up to the $54.9 trillion mark from the current $36 trillion. So, again, roughly, it's $2 trillion a year. It's what they show the average excess. And by the way, $2 trillion sounds like a lot of money. Well, it is. But look at what gets you there. The math that gets you there is you've got, and this becomes more apparent, the bad spot that we're in. We collect as tax receipts as a government. We collect about $5 trillion per year, and we're spending approximately, it's just north of $7 trillion per year. That's how you get to $2 trillion. So what is that? Basically a 50%, well, depending on how you do the math, about 50% portion of what we're actually collecting. We're shy. We're low by about 50%. That's, again, it's crazy. But the CBO, the thing that's kind of scary, and again, this is a year ago. I'll try to grab the new one here on the break. The CBO explained that much of the growth in the national debt over the next decade, so this is up through 2034, will be driven by increasing mandatory spending. This is part of that extra $100 trillion that we're talking about, that we don't really book on our balance sheet, but it'll be the increase over the next 10 years is going to go up dramatically because of mandatory spending on entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, as well as the cost of serving the national debt. In other words, the interest that we're paying, the debt service that we pay on the debt, and just, you know, the amount of the interest alone is staggering. Let me see something. The U.S. total interest paid right now, according to the U.S. Debt Clock, I'm looking at it real time. It's usdebtclock.org for those of you that want to take a look at it. And if you really want to stay in touch, you can add their mobile app to your phone. Looks like a pinball machine the way it's clicking off in real time. But the U.S. total interest paid is $5.1 trillion essentially, and that's, you know, the we crossed the $1 trillion mark for the first time annually in 2024. Let's see here. In terms of the budget categories, interest on the debt, I'm sorry, the total interest paid is $1.34 trillion, and that was just over $1 trillion for the September 30 fiscal year this past 2024. But in any event, that leaped over the defense spending. Defense spending is about $875 billion. By the way, put that in perspective with what we've provided Ukraine. I was just listening to a discussion of this yesterday, and we're somewhere in the $200 billion range to date. And I know that that's not necessarily just paid to Ukraine. I mean, really, we're paying our defense contractor or manufacturing community to make new versions of weapons that apparently we keep. We give Ukraine all the old stuff. But I think when you're providing the level we have, you've probably worked your way into some of the new stock in the arsenal. But anyway, defense used to be the third largest component of the budget if you're looking at the top four. And now interest is in the third spot. Social Security is in the second spot at $1.4, almost $1.5 trillion. And Medicare and Medicaid are $1.67 trillion. Medicare, as we've discussed before, has roughly 11,000 people. I believe it's 10,800 or so coming on to the Medicare rolls on a daily basis. Think about what that does to that spending category. And that's why it's the biggest. 1.7, or yeah, roughly 1.7 was the Medicare component, 1.661. It's a lot of money, and as indicated earlier, that's going to be a big driver in the go forward, the top two categories of Social Security and Medicare. Let's do this. Let's go ahead and take our first break. We'll be back here momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And I'll try to put my hands on that latest report from CBO. Okay, we'll circle right back momentarily.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
Did you know 76% of Americans are concerned they won't have a secure retirement? BeAPlanner.com shows how private real estate partnerships can increase current cash flow and retirement savings. There are three options to control your 401 and IRAs, but only one will double your retirement lifestyle. BeAPlanner.com for the Be A Planner show with CPA Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough.
Okay, welcome back with more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CBA. And just before the break, we were talking about the Congressional Budget Office 10-year forecast, which for the fiscal 2025, which would be October 1st of 2024 through September 30th, 2025. You know, it's interesting. I mean, this is such a moving target because the numbers that CBO projected, of course, didn't include any Trump administration tax cuts or tariffs. I guess we can hope, right, that the tariffs will work as intended and be a one-way street, bringing us many prosperous receipts as we move forward. But in any event, I would tell you that even though the CBO forecast shows a budget deficit, it's slightly under what they're projecting on average for the 10-year period. It's $1.865 trillion, and that's a little bit less than what I believe we had. I've seen several numbers regarding fiscal year 24, and it's I'm not sure as to which assumption sets are being generated, but we refer to it as $2 trillion because on average that's what it's going to be. But in any event, the Congressional Budget Office on Friday, this was Friday a week ago, forecasts a $1.865 trillion U.S. budget deficit for fiscal 2025, largely flat with last year and indicating no major deterioration in, I mean, if you can say this with a straight face, no major deterioration in government finances that has a, you know, almost $37 trillion cumulative deficit before President-elect Trump takes office on Monday, or as we know, took office on Monday. The CBO baseline estimates are based on current laws and assume that Trump's 2017 tax cuts, individual tax cuts, expire as scheduled at the end of this year, causing rates to snap back to higher levels. And that's another reason you may want to execute a Roth conversion before you get to the end of this year. You don't have to do the whole amount of your pre-tax dollars, but as we'll discuss a bit more towards the end of the show, the Roth is the most common tool that most taxpayers, if you have retirement funds, that's the most common tool that you can use to keep your taxes to a minimum as you get to retirement. There's others, but it typically takes more cash to execute others, such as a index universal life policy. That's a great tax mitigator, but you've got to have the money to make the premium payments either up front or along the way, and they've got to be more significant than the Roth conversion typically. Depends on what we're converting and what the valuations yield, etc. But in any event, efforts by Trump and Republicans in Congress to extend current federal individual and small business tax rates could add over $4 trillion to deficits over the next 10 years, if not offset with savings elsewhere. Well, savings, tariffs, you know, there's other ways to grab extra tax receipts. Other tax breaks promised by Trump, such as exempting Social Security, tip, and overtime income from taxation, could add even more debt. The CBO data shows that deficits declined slightly to $1.687 trillion in fiscal 2027 before gradually rising to $2.637 in 2033. The 2026 to 2035 cumulative deficit is estimated to be at $21.758 trillion. Just for those 10 years, $21.758 trillion. So like I indicated, it's an average of $2 trillion a year, 2.1, I guess, is close, or 5.8%. The 21.758 number or the annual amount that gets us there is roughly 5.8% of GDP. Let's see, the 21 trillion would be about 5%, 5.8%. Let's see, there's a comment here. So the CBO director, Philip Swagel, said the slight improvement in the near-term outlook was largely due to higher revenue projections linked to upward revisions of CBO's benchmark deficits or estimates of the overall size of the U.S. economy. Well, you know, that could be a fairly large bogey in the concept or the context of this study, because again, with a better economy, likely the tax collections go up, obviously. And this doesn't include any tariff activity or any more than what we have in the baseline for 2025. CBO's forecasting a slightly lower economic growth rate for the U.S. for 2025 compared with it's just slightly less, 1.9%, although on these dollars, that's a lot of money. Compared to 2.0% in the most recent update of the 2024 to 2034 window back in June. But in any event, Trump's pick to lead the U.S. Treasury, Scott Bessent, I believe is how you say it, Bessent, Fed hedge fund manager, Trump's referred to him as the smartest man on Wall Street many times, told the senators that failure to extend expiring tax cuts would cause a massive tax increase that would be an economic calamity and cause a sudden stop to U.S. growth. And, you know, these folks are a lot smarter than I am. I'll fully admit that. I would like to see a definition of massive calamity and sudden stop to U.S. growth. I think there's so many balls in the air. There's so many moving pieces here. Who knows? I mean, I would say on average, I mean, when you look back at what happened right after the 2017 Act took effect, there was very much a large increase in activity. So I guess I could take your word for it, but boy, right now we've got a lot of stuff going on that could counteract or offset, or I don't know, if they all went the wrong way, I guess it could be a calamity or a massive cause, massive tax increases. I mean, the biggest thing about the 2017 Act tax brackets that it brought in was it wasn't so much the rate. The rate came down slightly, but it sliced and diced the rates into more brackets, so that if you know, maybe had been in a certain bracket under the old calculations, you could find yourself in a lower bracket at the top end of it, where you would be somewhat better off. And I guess when you adopt that or apply that to the entirety of the U.S. taxpayer base, well, then yeah, that turns into a lot of money. Let's talk a bit more globally about your investing. And you know, we mentioned earlier partnership investing, specifically real estate private partnerships. And the beauty of real estate, number one, is that we get certain tax breaks, even as the 2017 Act is phasing out some of our favorites, like bonus depreciation. It's still better than what we would have ordinarily. And I would suggest that bonus tax depreciation, it would be, I don't know, I shouldn't say unlikely. I would say it wouldn't surprise me to see that retained because of the general calamity we've had and are having, currently experiencing in the commercial real estate sector. So I don't want to dial that in just yet. But even without that, and that's really what my point is here, even without bonus depreciation, the ability to front load some depreciation using the cost segregation rules is something that affects many investors, not all investors, because again, the passive investor is subject to certain limitations on the losses that they can claim. But the bigger issue to me, and I've had many people over the years that I've consulted in this partnership area, that they don't really understand how a partnership works when they get into one of the real estate syndication investments. And of course, even more common than that is not understanding that a real estate private partnership is effectively a company. You're buying a piece of a company, and it's not a company that's publicly traded. It's not something you get into and get out of on a whim, and you don't necessarily count on dividends. I mean, even on the public exchanges, the companies that are traded publicly, a lot of them, I don't know the percentage, but it's a lot, don't pay dividends. And so I've heard people at times, especially here as of late with the debt problems that we've had, you know, the debt market's been struggling, and a lot of partnerships, especially in the real estate space, have seen their interest rates on their debt increase, and the cash flow has been deviated, if you will, from what was projected would be paid to the partners, the investors, the passive investors, to paying the additional interest on the debt. And more than a few people have said, well, you know, I was supposed to get they think of it as a dividend. It's not. It's a partner distribution, I guess, somewhat akin to a dividend. It's money that the company doesn't anticipate needing. Well, when the interest rate has clicked up 11 times by the Fed Reserve, there's not going to be a lot of that cash laying around on the dates that one might assess whether we're going to need the money. It's always a resounding yes, we're going to need the money. In fact, we're going to need more than we have, and that's why we've got such a tremendous amount of distress in the current bridge loan pool that's supporting a lot of the syndication market. And this year is going to be a tough year for a lot of those transactions. You got to be hyper careful about jumping into something that's got a short term, you know, like a 3-year bridge type. That's BRIDGE, a bridge loan that's designed to transition a project into a permanent loan that's maybe a 10-year type agency loan, Freddie or Fannie backed. That's really what you want to try to get into if you're considering investing, and make sure that the pro forma information very clearly projects that information, because that's where we've gotten such a tremendous amount of distress. But bottom line is, you can't just count on distributions being paid out of real estate partnerships, because there's so many other factors that affect that cash flow. You know, insurance costs have gone up threefold and fourfold over the last few years. The taxes that are being paid or assessed to real estate, commercial and residential, have gone up significantly. And, you know, if that's not enough, the number of new units that have come into most major markets is significantly high, that it's caused the absorption rate to decline. And so you combine all those factors, and there's a lot to keep your eye on when you're looking at whether you should invest. And, you know, in our case, we subscribe to data from roughly, well, I don't know, it's 20 plus markets around the country, where we know what the average current average rental growth rate might be that you would look to see in a project in a given market or submarket, and you know what the absorption rate is, how fast new units are being rented in a market. You know what the vacancies are. You know assorted math metrics that you, if you don't understand that, you're going to be in for some rude awakenings as you move forward, because it's a tough, cold world out there when you get in to the debt market and the insurance cost, et cetera. And, you know, you don't want to necessarily overcapitalize a project, as I've seen happened often. I mean, I would still like the ability to invest more when it's needed so I can make money on my money as opposed to it sitting in a syndicator's bank account. But you've got to have some planning. You've got to have a lead partner or sponsor or syndicator, whatever term you would like to apply, that's got a steady hand on the wheel, that's done this before. I can't emphasize that enough. And I hate to say it, because there's new syndicators coming in the market all the time, and some of them are no doubt going to be awesome. I'll let somebody else help get them to awesome from newbie, because there's too much money and there's too much risk involved in not knowing whether or not someone has been to the finish line before and knows what that looks like and understands what can happen on the way to the finish line and how to deal with it. And you want people that have a better balance sheet perhaps than yours, or a group of them. If you've got a group that's been investing together, that's even better, that those investors would come back together to do another transaction. So in any event, so now let's meander back over to that tax train, now that we understand a little bit about how partnerships work. And by the way, I want to clarify one thing. I know I have clients that get K-1s each year, and they look at the amounts that are being reported and say, well, wait a minute, I didn't get any money this year, or I didn't get that much money, what it's showing on the K-1. Well, you have to understand that what you're going to see on a K-1 is what the partnership experienced, and then you get your relative percentage of that. And you also have to understand that things like debt payments, and there may be others, are not deductible per se. So you won't see those coming out of the top line or the net income line. You'll see interest, which is the interest expense, but if there's principal being paid, as there are on most loans, I mean, there are some interest-only loan variety, but that won't reduce, the principal payments don't reduce the amount of income that perhaps is being recognized as taxable. So it's not like your small business where you've got a sole proprietor, and at the end of the year, there's just a few numbers you might look at. You know, you've got your collections, you've got your expenditures, including, let's leave inventory to the side for the moment. Let's just make it clean. It's money in, money out. The net, there's your number. That's how much money you made and likely how much you would be taxed on. And that's a very simplistic example, but that's typically not how the partnership form operates. It could, if it was that simplistic scenario, but the apartment buildings and real estate generally is not that simplistic. So in any event, you're going to have some taxable income at some point in most of your apartment type transactions, but typically it may be, well, with bonus depreciation having been cut back due to the phase out, it may be sooner rather than later, but we would normally expect the big dollars as far as taxable to come towards the end when you exit. And so the interim years, if you've got taxable income, hopefully you've got some cash flow distributions, if you will, partner distributions, to give you some help on paying the tax. But the way you want to monitor or moderate your tax is consider if you invested with your retirement funds. And I would encourage people to use retirement funds, because that gives you a nice glide path to do a Roth conversion to where you're getting valuation discounts to a level below what you invested with. So if you put $100,000 in and now you're going to do a Roth, you want to look at the private company discounts that might apply, the lack of marketability. I mentioned earlier, you can't just go sell your ownership interest. You want to look at lack of majority control. You want to look at the economic factors that might be at play. I mentioned the debt markets. I mentioned the insurance rates going up, taxes going up. These all allow you to value that partnership that you're looking to convert. And you don't even have to sell it. You simply value the amount of value on a given transaction that you want to convert or make Roth of the Roth nature of a 401 or an IRA. You calculate the tax on your current year personal tax return. So nothing's changed hands. You've paid some money to the IRS, but from that point forward, qualified distributions, and qualified is defined. I'm not going to go into the definition, but you know, you've got a couple 5-year rules in play, and but assuming they're qualified, you pay no tax moving forward. That's the way you deal with the tax train. What do you think the rates? I've mentioned what the deficits are. How much do you think the rates might have to go up to keep us in the position where we can afford to even pay 100% of the interest on the debt? And if you think, oh, well, that'll never happen, well, guess what? We're about 4 to 5 years away from that point with the current level of spending and tax receipts. The discretionary part of the budget, the part that we can still argue about in Congress, you know, they spend a lot of time over that relatively small piece of the budget. And you may be asking, well, where's the rest of the budget going? Well, that's those mandatory spending items that we discussed earlier. The indexing, the defense would be in there. I think most of us would consider that mandatory. It may not technically be, but it is if it's my home that you're trying to protect in the homeland, you know, our home country. And then, you know, assorted other things, education and well, Medicare and Medicaid are the big ones, but in any event, it's quite a bit that is coming between us and the discretionary portion that we argue over. Well, listen, if you're interested in learning more about Roth and why you would do a Roth, I had that question recently, and I just said, look, when do you plan on dying? Give me that number and I'll give you an amount of money that it will save you. It's a tremendous amount of money. The longer, the better. But anyway, well, we're at the end of the show. I appreciate you tuning in, and we will be back on Sunday at 7 a.m. right here on AM 700. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.